welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Noach. Please take a moment and review the podcast. Your reviews make a big difference, and people really look at others' reviews to decide what podcast to listen to. And of course, mentioning it to your friends would also be very much appreciated. Thanks very much. This week, Noach with Rabbi Mike Fuhrer. Rabbi Mike Fuhrer is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Mike Fuhrer.
You know, names are a beautiful thing. And often they can actually tell us quite a bit about a person. And in fact, the Torah sometimes gives us insight into a person's character before they develop. And furthermore, in the role they're going to play in the story through their name. And Noach is a prime example. Because even before his parsha proper begins, actually at the end of last week's reading, the end of the beginning, so to speak, we learned a critical aspect of Noach's role that's going to come through sweetening the judgment of humanity. And furthermore, it's something that can tie together a story of human nature, of a disastrous flood, and even of the Tower of Babel that comes at the end of his tale. And it's right there in Bereishit, Genesis 5:29. V'yikra shmo Noach, l'mor Lamech had a son, and he called his name Noach, saying, this one will provide us relief from ma'aseinu u'me'itzvon yadenu, from our work and the toil of our hands, out of the very soil which the Lord placed under a curse. So in order to understand Noach's name and the significance of it, we're going to have to know what exactly is this ma'aseinu, these works of ours, u'itzvon yadenu, the toil of our hands, that is coming to provide relief. So let's go back to the beginning, to Adam and Chava, to Adam and Eve. You know, there are many things they do in the garden. They get quite a bit of text, but the ma'aseh, the action, I would say, that defines their story is reaching out to take the fruit. Oy, Adam, why? And I think on some level we all know the answer. The fruit's just too tempting to pass up. If you could reach out and have whatever you wanted, would you hold back? Anyway, it's a moot point, because they did. And so if you'll go with me that this is the ma'aseh, the action for which Noach is bringing us relief, then we simply have to explain, what is this itzavon, this thing that the translator here calls toil? Now, if we're going to get at that, we need to look at the consequences of what exactly Adam and Eve did. Right? There in the third chapter, in the 16th and 17th line, God says to the woman, I will make most severe your pangs in childbearing. In pain you shall bear children, your urge shall be to your husband, and he shall rule over you. And to the man he says, cursed be the ground because of you. By toil you shall eat it all the days of your life. And then he announces, by the sweat of your brow, you'll eat your bread. Now, it's a little bit obtuse in the English, but if you look in the Hebrew, you'll see that the root ayin, tzadi, bet, etzev, actually shows up three times in the description of their punishment, if you want to call it that. And I've always been taught that any word which shows up twice in close proximity should raise your radar. And if it shows up three times, you may not go forward until you tell me why. And so, what is this itzavon, this etzev? Well, of course, there are many answers, because that's the way we are. But I'm going to follow in the footsteps of the Radak, of David Kimchi, that oh-so-important 13th century Provençal. He says, itzavon tohana, you're going to eat it in this state of itzavon. You'll have to work the soil until you'll be able finally to eat its produce. You got to do the work, because up till now, apparently, Adam and Chava didn't have to do any work in order to eat. The Ramchal says all they had to do was reach out and pluck the fruit from the trees in Gan Eden. That sound familiar? So, before we get a little bit further in that, it's important to note that in this curse, the ground is cursed as well. Which seems just a little bit unfair. I mean, I understand Adam and Chava paying the price for their actions, but what did the ground have to do with it? And if we want to know that, we need to go back to the first story of creation, that first chapter, which is just an endless source of speculation about the nature of being. And if you look back there, in the first chapter on the 11th and 12th line, particularly Rashi on the 12th line, you'll see that Rashi, in the footsteps of our sages, notes a strange inconsistency between lines 11 and 12. In line 11, the earth was commanded to bring forth fruit trees which bear fruit. But in the description of what happened in the next line, 12, it says that the earth brought forth trees which bore fruit. Now, something which you or I might not even notice becomes a foundation of thought for how the sages relate to the human condition. And see what Rashi says. He says the original intention was that the taste of the tree be exactly the same as that of the fruit. However, it doesn't happen, because then the earth brought forth a tree yielding fruit. The tree itself was not fruit, says Rashi. And that's why, he goes on to explain, that when Adam was cursed on account of his sin, the earth was also cursed. I fail to see the connection immediately. Now, what does it mean that the taste of the tree was meant to be the same as the taste of the fruit? Could be many things. I'm going to once again follow in the footsteps of Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, that awesome illuminary of the early 20th century. And he defines this interaction as an alienation of the process from the product. You can look in depth on the source sheet that's provided if you want to understand his thought. But for now, just imagine that if the first time you went to work out, I mean, it's after Yom Kippur, I'm sure we all made plenty of resolutions. I want to get in shape. Just imagine if the first time I went out to run, it felt just as good as it did after being in shape for months. Or in fact, that any process was as enjoyable as the end product I'm after. If that were the case, you would never hold back from doing anything that mattered to you. And that's what it'd be like if you could taste the sweetness of the fruit in the tree. If you could taste the pleasures of the product in the process itself. Oy, Adam. So, the act of Adam and Eve was to reach out and take the fruit. To ignore consequence in terms of divine command, and to just take what they wanted. And we see in the third chapter that the result was itzavon. Life's no longer about plucking the low-hanging fruit. Now we're going to have to work for it, says the Radak. And furthermore, in that link between the curse of the earth and how it comes to fruition, pun intended, in Adam's curse, that work we have to do will not be sweetened by the taste of the purpose. It will be toil. Just to make it clear, the sin of the earth in separating process from product manifests through humanity's taking of the fruit as a sense that efforts are dissipation unless they're directly embodied in the result. And Noah comes to change all this. So now, what exactly does the promise of Noah's name mean? Right, he's going to ze yinahameinu. He's going to comfort us. And here Rashi says, he will ease from off of us the toil of our hands. Meaning what? That apparently until Noah came, people had no agricultural tools, and he is the one that prepared them. You know, the earth had been bringing forth thorns and thistles since Adam got cursed and the earth together with him. And therefore, when they would sow wheat, they wouldn't actually get what they were after. That's the sense of dissipation and meaningless work. But apparently in the days of Noah, this ceased. He's getting rid of the curse of the ground, this kotz vidardar, as it says back in the third chapter, right? Thorns and thistles, vidardar, you can hear in that the Hebrew of lehit darder, is to just dissipate out into nothingness. So now the etzev, that toil which the Radak defined for us as effort toward end, is going to be greatly lessened as Noach's amazing technological advance brings bumper crops to the descendants of Adam. So, Noach is the John Deere of the Bible? That doesn't make sense. But we saw, actually, that etzev isn't just toil in the physical sense. It's the particular pain we experience when toil is accompanied by a sense of futility, or at least a lot of wasted effort. And, furthermore, when we look forward in his story, we see that Noach himself lives the change that he's meant to bring to the world. And when God says, I've decided to put an end to all flesh, make yourself an ark of gopher wood, Noach gets to work. I mean, the plans are actually quite detailed and the project seems immense. And furthermore, it seems from the plain meaning of the text that it took him 100 years to build it. That's a lot of process to produce one ark, life-saving as it may have been. So what kept Noah going for so long? Especially as his friends and neighbors began to mock him, according to the Midrash, actually threatened that if he ever went into the thing, they'd tear it apart and him limb from limb. I'd like to imagine that part of how he got through this process was how he himself grew through his labors. Because when we experience etzev, that sense of wasted effort in our striving for a goal, often it's because I'm operating on the assumption that the product is the only goal of the process which I have undertaken. That's as opposed to valuing the transformation which I can possibly undergo through the focused exercise of my will toward a goal. I'll give you an example. I have a student, wonderful person, who is third or fourth, if she's listening, she'll forgive me, fourth degree black belt in Aikido. Pretty impressive. I don't mess with her, right? And we were having a discussion the other day about the difference between that and Keanu Reeves at that magic moment in The Matrix when he wakes up and says, "I know Kung Fu." So which one would you rather be? A woman who's worked for decades in order to achieve a level that Keanu Reeves got in one simple download? I mean, the product is the same. I won't answer the question for you, but let's just think about this, that there is a tremendous benefit in who I become through the process of exercising my will toward a focused goal, which is actually somewhat separate from the product itself. So, Noach lightens the burden of the curse, bringing relief to the world, and he engages in a prolonged process whose goal is to save the world. And, you know, we have another characterization of Noach which can, I think, bring a deeper light to his nature. Right at the beginning of his parasha, the verse says, "Noach ish tzadik tamim haya bedorotav, et ha'elohim hitalech Noach." And even though his characterization as a righteous and almost perfect person might seem to be why God chose him to build the ark, I suspect it's actually the latter half of the verse, "Et ha'elohim hitalech Noach," that Noach went with God, which I want to read in light of what we're saying, is that wherever Noach went, whatever process in which he was engaged, he was with God, and therefore was building himself. But we know that the job of fixing Adam's failure doesn't actually end with Noah. And frankly, if you read forward in the story after the drama of the flood, it doesn't end so well. True, Noah succeeds in surviving the flood, and he gets out, and there's the beautiful rainbow and God's promise under its sign never to bring the flood again. And there's sacrifices, and it's really dramatic. But the next day, he goes out and gets good and drunk. A story which doesn't end so well. I'll let you read it yourself. And then to cap it off, his parsha, his story as it's presented in the weekly reading of the Torah, finishes with the story of the Tower of Babel. What's up with that? I suspect that we're seeing the limitations, actually, of what Noach had to offer, and which are also embodied in his name. Noah, through his technological advances and through his commitment to building the ark, indeed removed the bitterness of our labor and acted as a personal example of what can be accomplished, who one can become through a commitment to process as well as product. But the problem is, both the thorns and thistles which the earth brought up and the flood which God brought down were not actually the problem, though he was solving them. They were the symptoms. Right? The flood wasn't the problem. The text makes very clear that the cause of the flood was man's wickedness on earth and how every plan devised by his mind was nothing but evil all the time. Noah didn't touch this. His 100 years of labor after hearing from God the command to build the ark may have perfected his own heart and given him the merit to survive, but as the sages point out, he didn't once pray for the people around him. He never argued with the judgment. He just worked to stave off its consequences. And What the ultimate cause of Adam's decision was, I'll leave for your own judgment. But certainly we can agree that the thorns and thistles which the ground brought up were the symptoms of failures, not the root cause. And I will suggest that Adam exercised his will, and not just in opposing God, but rather that he did so in a way which separated product from process, and so the ground was cursed for his sake, which can be read on a moral plane as a punishment, right? It's your fault, Adam. Adama, ba'avurecha, because of you, the ground is cursed. But you could also read it on the existential plane as an indication of how he's meant to better himself. Aruha Adama ba'avurecha. I cursed it for your sake, Adam, for your good, that I gave you a world in which you could experience dissipation and labor, and now you have a chance to learn to exercise your will through commitment to a goal and to become more of who you could be. Noah got that. But he only shared the technical fix with the world. He built a better plow, 100-year arc of self-improvement project, but he didn't pray for the people. And so, when Noah, through his agricultural advances, removed the bitterness of labor without addressing the core reason God had made it so to begin with, we get the Tower of Babel. We get the ability to challenge God on a scale uninhibited by dissipation or technical limitations of process and product. And we're going to have to wait another 10 generations of the Torah until someone comes along who learns to exercise his will. He exercises to defy the whole world, who has enough sense of self that he can actually stand up even to God, and who uses that will and that power to speak to the evil in the hearts of humanity. But the story of Abraham will have to wait till next week. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Fuhr. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.